all have gotten passed, for example, in New York State alone, to allow people who've been abused decades ago to be able to come forward and sue Dr. Haddon, who's in prison, but also take on a medical institution. If you could quickly, and if you feel comfortable, saying what happened to you, and Eva, I want to ask you the same, and then what it took, even if it took years because of whatever your reasons for coming forward. And your response to the settlement.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy. I know Democracy Now! Has covered our story numerous times. I think we've been on here 4 times, so thank you. It means so much. The settlement is huge. It was just a huge win for all of survivors, including Haddon survivors, but all of survivors. And I also have to say that it took a really long road to get there. Anthony DiPietro has been at that fight for more than 10 years. A lot of us have just joined or have been in it for years, but there's been so much coming forward. And it really has been on The Voice. Of survivors and the bravery of survivors sharing their stories, their vulnerabilities. And it's been survivors who have notified other survivors to come forward. You know, Haddon is the biggest sexual predator in the history of the United States. Eva and I are a few of thousands of women that he sexually abused. I was sexually assaulted 2 days before the birth of my son. But there are so many women that were...
you went to him because you were about to give birth.
Yes.
And you thought, he said to come to his office rather than the hospital for a checkup.
Yeah. 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 So, and the pain that he caused, the physical pain, it was just egregious.
How long did it take you, and when did you realize that this was, you were not alone?
Oh, gosh. I first found out when a woman came forward, Lori Kanyok came forward, called 911. There was in the newspaper on the subway. It was like, gyno is a sicko. So that was my first.
So you're looking across the subway at the guy across from you, and they have a newspaper and a picture of your doctor, gyno is a sicko, and you go, that's Dr. Haddon.
That's my doctor. And that's my doctor of, you know, almost 10 years. Like, that's my doctor of, you know, that I, my first OBGYN. And so it was women kind of notifying other women. Other people have been notified by Instagram, on subway ads. And, you know, I first was following it, and I first, of course, came forward to, I was moved to another doctor and just asked, was this, you know, was this a medical procedure? No. And you know, at that point, Columbia, you know, they kind of do their best to sort of silence you. So it took me a while. I think it took me a while to overcome the shame and the fear. And then once I did, and I came forward to Anthony and was a part of this legal lawsuit, I really found my voice. And I noticed that the more that I spoke, the more women came forward. So that happened again after, you know, and we're really... It's women's work. It's survivors' work. But there's legal's work. We've had investigative journalists. There's so many things that have happened.
And Lori, when you mentioned that Columbia did what they could to silence you, could you talk about that? The fact that the university for so long had to be aware of what was going on, but did nothing about it.
Juan just asked you, Lori, you said Columbia silenced you, but did nothing about it. Explain what took place. I remember seeing you when Manu Shafiq, the former president of Columbia, was being inaugurated, and the survivors were there, all these medical doctors at Columbia, residents, students in their white coats protesting, demanding that Columbia alert all of the patients of Haddon about what, you know, what he's being charged with if they wanted to come forward.
Oh, my goodness. There were Columbia University, they never notified patients up until a few days before survivors had a chance to take legal action. So there was more than 6,000 patients. And yeah, they finally notified after protest. And that was really important.
I'd like to ask Eva Santos if you could talk about your situation. Specifically, you were undocumented at the time you first dealt with Dr. Haddon or were a patient of his, and how that affected your ability to speak out.
Sure. So, I mean, being undocumented back then in 2008 was the main reason why I couldn't speak up. I felt afraid of being a Latina woman in a country that already doesn't stand up for us. And I just felt really afraid and ashamed if they were going to believe me. So I didn't say anything. I bottled it up for years until I was finally able to see powerful women like Lori, like Marisa, come forward. That gave me the courage to know that I was going to be protected. Also, Anthony Di Prieto gave me the power and courage to finally know that what I went through was real and it wasn't something that was just being silent and hidden by Columbia.
You were giving birth to your first son at the age of 18, and you were in an emergency delivery, and this guy walks in?
Yes.
2008.
Yeah, I was 18 years old. This was my first birth. During my labor, he sexually assaulted me multiple times, not just once. I was there for many hours, and he used his power in order to make me feel like what he was doing was right.
You were undocumented, afraid to come forward for years?
Correct. Yeah, I was really afraid to come forward. But I'm no longer afraid. They will not silence me. It's something that Columbia has the power of doing, believe that they have the power of doing, but they don't. And I will continue to use my voice to hold them accountable, regardless of my status.
I wanted to ask Anthony Di Pietro to talk about the evolution of this case, how you got involved, and the numbers of people that have come forward.
Again, Anthony cannot hear Juan, but Juan asked how many people were involved, how many women survivors, how'd you get involved in this case?
Yeah. So to date, our firm has represented 808 women who have come forward to report on being sexually exploited and abused by Robert Haddon at Columbia University. The really tragic part of this is that the university knew all the way back into the 90s about what he was doing and how he was mistreating patients, but did nothing but lie, cover it up, and expose more unsuspecting patients to a known serial predator.
But explain. I mean, actually, you have achieved altogether with your settlements over $1 billion. Columbia University, and you can explain the different medical institutions where he worked, Columbia Presbyterian, representing people like Evelyn Yang, who is the wife of the presidential candidate, everyone learning from everyone else, women who came forward. Explain how that were over $1 billion Columbia is paying out. What did they not do? When did they know that he was a predator?
Yeah, so Columbia knew all the way back into 1995 when a patient wrote a letter to their chairman. And who wrote back? He acknowledged receipt of the letter. She wrote to the chairman, risk management, and the hospital itself. And they did nothing except cover this up. And the reason why these cases are so important is if you look at what happened at Columbia with Haddon, at Weill Cornell with Darius Paduke, at Michigan with Larry Nassar, USC with George Tyndall, UCLA with James Heaps, the one thing these institutions have in common is that the one thing these cases have in common is that the institutions always know the abuse is happening. So it's important that we make them, we hold them accountable. We hit them where it hurts, because the only thing they really care about, and they've shown this again and again, is their money and their reputation. And so it's really important that they understand that we're here, we're watching them, and we're going to hold them accountable if they don't take proper action.
Can you explain something? This is not only about Columbia. It's also about the Manhattan DA, who was Cyrus Vance at the time. It is astounding the deal they made with him. And explain that.
It's outrageous. So in 2016, over 20 women had come forward to report the abuse to the district attorney's office in New York City. That included a fellow employee of Robert Haddon's, an employee of Columbia University. They indicted him for 6 women. The district attorney's office then allowed Haddon to pick any 2 of the 6 women that he wanted, plead guilty to them. One of them he made oral contact with. Another one of them he forcibly assaulted. And they gave him what more closely resembles an early paid retirement instead of a sentence for a sexual felon. No jail, no fine, no community service. They didn't even take his license. They allowed him to surrender his medical license.
And no jail at that time.
Nothing.
What caused him to go to jail?
Not a thing. I'm convinced it is the collective voices of all these women who have come forward, who would continue to talk about this. This case started back before, you know, the term Me Too was in the public consciousness, before anyone heard of Nassar, unless they were a patient of his being abused by him. And the dialogue kept going and growing, and the movement kept gaining power. Ultimately, it was the letter that was found in Utah from Columbia's chairman, who apologized to the patient in 1995 for being assaulted, and he told her he was going to take care of this when he got back from vacation, and never did a thing except cover it up and expose more people. And ultimately, when those reports started gaining traction, that seems to be when the federal prosecutor stepped in, indicted him again, and now he's in prison for what hopefully will be the rest of his life.
Huh. Yeah, and I wanted to ask Eva, and maybe Anthony DiPietro could also talk about this. What kind of long-term changes has Columbia agreed to that you think are most important?
I think they haven't agreed to anything other than the settlement. They haven't done anything other than cover up this abuse for many, many years. Maybe they have offered a patient safety clinic, something like that, but nothing has really happened. We are in conversations with the Attorney General's office to see how we are going to have institutional accountability. Because, again, this cannot just stay on a settlement offer payment, because they have all the money to continue to pay abuse as much as they many more years. What is going to happen in each clinic and each hospital to make sure that this doesn't happen again? They have yet to say that, and we are waiting for them to come forward and say how that's going to look like.
Many people are getting Robert Haddon's name off your child's birth certificate.
Yes.
That's part of the deal.
Yes.
And for Eva, you now have 3 kids. You're DACA. You talked with me earlier about how your mother was your support, but also feels guilty about not speaking out earlier. What message you have to young, vulnerable people who are terrified to come forward, yet know, and you knew from that moment in your greatest pain around delivery, that there was something really bad happening here?
I'll say more than anything to trust yourself. Trust yourself. Once you have that feeling that something is wrong, something is definitely wrong. I knew it since the first moment that he did it, and I've been holding it ever since. And it's just a matter of trusting yourself and using the people around you and your community to be supported and come forward. And know that you have the protection, you have the resources, you have great lawyers like Anthony DiPietro that will support you along the way, and great collective sisters that, like I found, that has made this journey easier. Or else I would have been really alone throughout this time.
These are the largest settlements in U.S. history, well over $1 billion, vying with USC, right? University of Southern California, Anthony.
Yes, that's correct.
Women, the average that they'll be getting is
Just over $1.3 million on a per case average, which
and
is the highest amount.
Number of women who are involved at this point?
576 in this current round.
Can other women come forward now that we'll hear this?
Yeah, so each case is going to have to be evaluated on an individual basis. You know, the work that everyone has done so far in passing a law called the Adult Survivors Act, passing a law called the New York Gender Motivated Violence Act, those statutes provided a temporary time frame for people to come forward, file a case, even though it was beyond the statute of limitations. Those have now ended, but there still could be opportunities for people to come forward on an individual basis.
And finally, Lori, your final comment as this chapter comes to an end. Robert Haddon in jail, Columbia and the Met and the hospital being held accountable. Your son is 17 years old. You were assaulted a few days before he was born.
Yeah, I think this is like a big win for us, just like Haddon being convicted. But when we were in court with Haddon, you know, he was put in handcuffs and taken to jail, and we were assured that he would, you know, never harm anybody again. That was the end of that. But there was nobody in the courtroom representing Columbia, and still to this day, they haven't done much, in terms of hearing our voices, in terms of making internal changes, in terms of external investigation, and that's what we're trying to put forth. And so, you know, my hope is holding Columbia accountable to that same level, and that is really a lot of, I feel like, survivors are a force to be reckoned with. We are a strong group. We do a lot of incredible things. And one of the things that Eva was really highlighting was, our work with the Attorney General's office. Like, if we want Columbia to change, that it's survivors that need to hold them to accountable. So we're really, this is huge. And at the same time, we have lots of work to do to make sure that this never happens at this scale again.
Lori Maldonado, Eva Santos Velos, and their attorney, Anthony T. DiPietro, representing hundreds of women who were sexually abused by Dr. Robert Haddon, now in jail for decades. When we come back, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights finds U.S. border agents responsible for torture in the beating death of a Mexican father in 2010. Stay with us.
Pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona que no se vuelva a quejar, no sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. O se atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no importa para el tío Sam. Suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar.
El Hielo, or Ice, by La Santa Cecilia, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has found Customs and Border Protection agents who fatally beat Mexican father Anastasio Hernandez Rojas are responsible for acts of torture. It's the first time the Independent Commission, which investigates extrajudicial killings and human rights violations, has issued such findings against a U.S. law enforcement agency. In 2010, Rojas was crossing the southern border in an attempt to return to San Diego, where he'd lived for 25 years to reunite with his wife and five children after being deported. He was stopped by border agents who brutally beat and tasered him while he was handcuffed until Rojas died from heart failure. His death was later ruled a homicide. In 2012, Democracy Now! Spoke to an eyewitness who recorded footage of the fatal beating. This is Umberto Navarrete.
Anastasio, face down in handcuffs, and two officers on uniform. And there were five officers in the near area right there when I started recording. Two uniform officers. One of them had one of his knees on Anastasio's neck. The other officer had the other knee on Anastasio's lower back. I started noticing all these details, and the most important thing was that Anastasio was not resisting, and that's when I decided to pull out my cell phone and start recording what you can see on the first videos, and that's when I started recording.
The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights findings on the killing of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas comes nearly a decade after his family filed a complaint in 2016. And this comes as President Trump's nominee to head Customs and Border Protection, Rodney Scott, faces questions about whether he obstructed the criminal probe into Rojas's killing in an attempt to cover up the ICE agent, the border agent's actions. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden raised concerns during Scott's confirmation hearing before the Senate Finance Committee last month.
In 2010, he led the U.S. Border Patrol in San Diego. While in that position, a migrant who crossed the border was detained by CBP officers and severely beaten while in their custody. The man we've mentioned, Mr. Rojas, died of those injuries, leaving behind his wife and five children. Rather than following the agency's own policy and immediately referring the incident to outside investigators, the San Diego CBP office began its own inquiry. In the course of that investigation, the CBP officers taped over the only video copy of Mr. Rojas' death and tampered with physical evidence, according to court documents. In an action that the former head of CBP Internal Affairs called illegal and possibly obstruction of justice, Mr. Scott signed a subpoena to obtain Mr. Rojas' medical records, which Customs and Border Patrol then refused to release to the San Diego Police Department.
Rodney Scott has yet to be approved by the Senate to head Customs and Border Protection. For more, we're joined by Andrea Guerrero. She is executive director of the San Diego Alliance. Welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can start off by talking about the significance of the findings.
Well, good morning, Amy. The decision from the Inter-American Commission is a catalyst in the fight for dignity in the United States. It exposes the unchecked powers of policing in the United States and holds the United States accountable for what is one of the worst violations in human rights, which is the taking of a life, and points to the U.S. policies as deficient and deadly. And that is a really significant finding for us in the fight for justice, in the fight for reform. This applies to all law enforcement, local police, federal agents, who are now being called to change their ways, and policymakers are being called to change their policies to avoid repetition so that no one has to suffer what the family of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas had to suffer.
And Andrea, is there any direct or legal impact of the commission's findings on the U.S., on the U.S. government?
The way the Inter-American Commission works is it issues recommendations, and until and unless the United States complies with those recommendations, it will remain in a monitoring status. It will be monitored by the commission for the duration of its reforms. And so the equivalent to this in the United States would be a consent decree. When a court takes a police department under its jurisdiction, in a consent decree to monitor it for reforms, to make sure that it institutes the reforms to avoid repetition of the harms it has caused in the past. And so what we're looking forward to is the United States complying with the recommendations of the commission, which are threefold. One, to reopen the investigation of the agents involved in both the abuse, torture, killing of Anastasio and the cover-up, to repair the damage to his reputation and apologize to the family, and three, to reform its laws and policies, namely its use of force laws and policies to align with the international human rights standards, which limit the use of force to that which is necessary and proportional. In the United States, we have a unique standard, unique in the world, which allows officers to use force if it is objectively reasonable. That standard is far from the international standard of necessary and proportionate, and it must change.
And the issue of the President Trump's pending nominee to Customs and Border Patrol, Rodney Scott, being part of that original cover-up, can you talk about the implications of that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the CBP commissioner nominee, Rodney Scott, is implicated in the decision from the Inter-American Commission. Rodney Scott was in charge of the San Diego sector of Border Patrol when Anastasio was killed, and he directly participated in the cover-up, principally by overseeing the cover-up teams called critical incident teams that were later disbanded because they never had any congressional authority to operate and because of the obstruction of justice that they were engaged in. In the case of Anastasio, Rodney Scott oversaw these teams and their destruction of evidence, and he also personally authorized an administrative subpoena that was used to acquire Anastasio's medical records from the hospital. And the reason why this is important is because he knew that he was using an immigration subpoena for a criminal homicide matter that he had no authority to be involved in. It was an investigation of his own agents, and he used this administrative subpoena to acquire evidence or information about Anastasio's medical and records in order to mitigate the liability of his agents. Now, everyone should know that administrative subpoenas, administrative warrants, are not self-executing. They are not judicial warrants that can compel the evidence or a witness or a person in a search or a seizure. And so this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's a violation of federal laws that limit administrative subpoenas to administrative matters. And that's not what Rodney Scott did. And I think what was most damning in the Senate hearing last month was that Mr. Scott said not only that he had authorized an administrative subpoena in the course of a criminal homicide investigation that he had no business being a part of, but that this was common practice and is common practice. So, you know, the way we see it is a person who cannot recognize abuse of power or participated in abuse of power is not a person who should hold power.
And we will see what happens. Again, the confirmation hearing has been held, but Rodney Scott has not yet been confirmed by the full Senate to be head of Border and Customs Patrol. That does it for our show. Andrea Guerrera, we thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the San Diego Alliance. You can visit democracynow.org to see all the coverage we've done on the death of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Every time you tune in to CJSF, you make a choice to step outside of the box of what's normal and support an alternative. Alternatives are critical for making change, which we need so, so badly. I'm Leslie, host of Typically Tuesdays, on Mondays at 3 p.m. And I see you contributing to social change in your small and profound ways simply by tuning into us. Thanks for being on our team.